way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face.
And we are live. I was just a little bit worried there. We didn't get started. I've got some construction going on. On the long-promised remodel of my office right across the hall. And those guys have been pretty good about staying away from the modem, but hopefully we won't have any disruptions due to that today. And they're making some noise over there, too, which is just unavoidable right now. I'm up against vacation time and all, so this needs to get done. But you may see me mute my end when we bring Travis on at times to deal with that. But I think we'll be fine today. It's going to be a cool ass interview. We're going to be talking to Travis Corcoran in just a minute, who's the author, among other books, of Red State Mars. This is a really cool book. They sent me a copy of it when we booked him. This is very interesting. And I know what you're thinking. Jack, you just said yesterday that no living person's going to be living on a colony. Well, not really no living person, but like terraformed colony. Like that's all not happening while we're around. Yeah, this is a science fiction book, and it's really freaking interesting. And what it's really about is liberty and what it takes to actually live like all the way off grid, true independence, getting along with other people and not getting along with other people. We're also going to be talking a lot about what Travis has done on his own homestead, some of his other books, and some really cool stuff. So this is going to be awesome, and it's not just about going to Mars. It's going to be a really deep intellectual discussion, and we will have Travis on in just a moment. Before we do, let's go ahead and recognize our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is Above Phone, where you can actually own your technology instead of having technology that's actually controlled by others. If it's controlled by somebody else, they're the real owner, not you. Your mobile device spies on you. Your desktop device spies on you. Your tablet spies on you. The app maker spy on you. Your carrier spies on you. Your ISP spies on you. And they all give away to your government and sell to anybody else with a credit card whatever data they want to buy about your behavior, your buying habits, all of that stuff. And for all their pledges of privacy, just dig into it and you'll see what I'm talking about. But you can make that go away at Above Phone, where you can get some of the most privacy-focused tablets, laptops, and phones on the planet. And they're an MSB member. They give you $75 off any phone at abovephone.com, which is 1.5 times the cost of your annual membership alone from just that one vendor. So great supporter, great technology. And if you're like, but Jack, I don't know if I'll be able to use this high-tech, newfangled stuff. First of all, it's not hard. If you can use your Windows machine or your Mac, you can use their devices. It's not that much different. But the other thing is, since there is a little bit of difference, they'll actually give you an expert with a 45-minute onboarding experience with any new device that you buy to help you out and how you use it. Next up today is the Case Place. This is one of those rare things where I occasionally actually bring on a new sponsor. I had a space open. I wasn't even advertising it, really. And these guys reached out, and I was like, yes, absolutely. This is right in the wheelhouse of my community. This is sponsorship as a service to the audience. What the Case Place does is they buy up overstocked, returned, or slightly damaged, and then they make sure that they're fully repaired cases. And we're talking military-grade storage cases, Pelican, Hardig, SKB, and others like that. And they sell them then at 50 to 80% off retail. They also do a discount of 10% for MSB members. But I was just reached out to today by the owner. He wants to start giving all of y'all a discount. I said, that's fine, as long as my MSB members get a better discount. So if you're MSB, you get 10% off all your purchases on top of up to 80% already off of retail. If you are not, you'll be able to soon, not today, but very soon, like the end of this week, get 5% off. So they're looking to really build relationship with the audience. They have a great product and a great reputation, been around a long time. With that, I want to go ahead and bring our special guest on. And with that, hey, Travis, man, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah, like I said, you probably don't catch the show all the time or anything, but yesterday we did a show on basically some of the things that we have had to admit were fantasies. And I said, there's no exiting, so you better build. And one of the discussions on there, somehow we ended up talking about Elon Musk and, you know, the Mars colony dreams and all. And what I said is, you know, if they ever actually pull off terraforming Mars, which is a big if, you won't be alive to see it. I won't be alive to see it. Your kids won't be alive to see it. Maybe your great-grandchildren, maybe. But that's not really what we're here to talk about today. I just want to float back because I know I'm going to get some pushback from somebody in the live comments or something like that because of what I said yesterday. But your book really isn't about, well, it is, but it isn't about going to Mars like that. It's sci-fi, right?
Yeah. You know, so I want to talk about the book, but, you know, you bring up a topic that's, you know, even more interesting or is tied into it, which is like, you know, so much science fiction and libertarianism. America's a frontier culture, right? We, you know, in 1600, the frontier was 3 miles off the Atlantic. And then just for centuries, you know, we lived at the frontier and we're frontier people because of that. And so, so much science fiction that is like really deeply, uniquely American is about a frontier. So, you know, here we are sort of stuck in the early 21st century and we're dreaming of, you know, go to Mars, go to the asteroid belt. And that's good. I want, you know, our grandchildren to be on the frontier. But on the meantime, you know, for today, we're here. And so we can't just all run away high up in the Rockies and play Wolverines. You know, that's not a way to defend our civilization and our society. We do need to, even while we've got an eye on the future, you know, an eye on 500 years out, we also need to work for 10 and 20 years out. And I'm actually a state rep here in New Hampshire. New Hampshire is the live free or die state. So, you know, even as I'm interested in technology and writing fiction to inspire the American spirit and talk about long-term plans, you know, I'm working for next week and tomorrow doing stuff like working with colleagues on in-state legal machine guns that, you know, hopefully aren't subject to ATF regulation, all sorts of other stuff. So look at the long game, but also, you know, fight for tomorrow and next year.
Yeah, we are big on a frontier type culture and going where others haven't gone. Like, this space is the final frontier, right? Star Trek. But this also kind of does ground me back. This actually wasn't what I planned on leading off with, but I had to cover it. But as you were talking and mentioned that frontier culture, it made me think of a song by the Eagles called The Last Resort.
Yes.
And there's a line in it that says, because there is no more new frontier, but we have got to make it here. And I think there's some reality to that. And that's what I was talking about yesterday. But I think looking to, you know, what if we did this? And what would it be like? And what new questions might come up from it, which is a lot of what your book is about, is really interesting. Before we dig into that, though, let's start off kind of at the genesis story for you. You and your wife both walked away from kind of like lucrative tech careers. And you moved to New Hampshire, your homestead. What pushed you to do that? That's kind of another new frontier story, right? Like, and that was actually my point. One of my big points yesterday was like, we live in this incredible republic. It's got problems, but it's still like the only place I know that both poor people and rich people line up to get in.
Right.
That's kind of really unique in the world. And a big part of it is the optionality that we have. So like New Hampshire was a place that you found something worth going after. And I think a lot of people can emulate that even if they choose a different place to do it. It fits more with what they want.
Yeah, no. And there are some, you know, good choices. It's not just New Hampshire. Although I've got friends will beat me up if I don't try to argue like, well, but New Hampshire is the best, even though they're all really good.
I'm familiar with the Free State Project.
Yeah. I wouldn't call myself a free stater, but I'm a fellow traveler, like the not quite commies used to say, fellow traveler. I had grown up, in the 70s, which is sort of in the wake of the first Back to the Land movement. You know, the first Back to the Land movement was the hippies in the 60s. And they were putting out books, Stuart Brand with the Whole Earth Catalog and, you know, playing around with ideas of solar panels and the very first personal computers. And Stuart Brand, he's still around. He was sort of an optimist, even while he was dissenting from the overculture. He was saying to dissent from the overculture doesn't mean that we should go anarcho-primitivist and eschew all technology. We should use technology to accomplish our goals. And so I moved on from there to the Foxfire books and absolutely loved them. And so there I was, you know, 12 or 13 years old in rural New Jersey thinking, you know, man, someday I want to live on a farm, teach myself to blacksmith. And unbeknownst to me, you know, 800 miles away, the woman who'd eventually be my wife is reading the Foxfire books and daydreaming. And she's thinking, you know, someday I'd like to grow up and marry a blacksmith and move to a farm. And so it took a long time for us to meet each other. But there we were sort of stuck in suburban Massachusetts. And we both wanted to be on a farm. Here is a little Easter egg that you weren't expecting. Your question turns out to be much more exciting than you knew. So the exact inciting incident was when I made some disrespectful comments about local politicians in my town of Arlington, Massachusetts, which one thing led to another, and that led to the Joint Terrorism Task Force raiding my house.
Wow.
Yes. The 10-second version of that is the Supreme Court Heller decision said that gun lock laws are unconstitutional, and then the McDonald decision said that that applies to states as well as to the federal government. But Massachusetts' stance on the time was, you know, the Supreme Court has made its ruling, now let it enforce it, to sort of paraphrase Andrew Jackson. And so they were operating in absolute defiance of Heller and McDonald, and they were sending people to jail, and that was happening. So Massachusetts and the local political structure found a pistol in my house that did not have a gun lock on it, and there was a lot of legal wrangling, and it was a very serious event. And the negotiated resolution was that we left the state ASAP. And happened to have the perfect timing where local real estate was at a peak and rural New Hampshire was somewhat cheap. And so traded into just an absolutely amazing farm, which for the last 12 plus years, I've been busting my butt on to, you know, cut down standing deadwood and eradicate invasive species and dig drainage and put in swales and plant orchards and everything. And if I'm allowed to do a quick plug, after a decade of that, I wrote my homesteading books, Escape the City, Volume 1, and this is not a small book, and Escape the City, Volume 2, the other half of it, also not small, and those are at Amazon. So I'm sort of an OCD spreadsheet guy with meticulous documentation and everything, so that is, I don't know, 1,500 pages of my notes.
Very, very cool. And I'm going to have links to all of his books and everything else that he sent me, and also Red State Mars, which is something we'll get to talking about here in just a minute. Let's talk about Escape the City. You wrote that from lived experience. That's
yeah.
Your own words. And this is something I've learned about everybody that actually does it, right? As soon as you actually do it, you realize that all like the heart hand Instagram shit and all is bullshit. Like you don't sit around all day looking at ducks and reading books. It's hard. And almost everybody comes away with there are false assumptions and misconceptions about self-sufficiency and homesteading that people have before they actually try it. What were some of your big ones?
Yeah, that is such a great statement you made, and I couldn't agree more. You know, and there's two varieties. There's sort of you know, boy version and girl version, and the girl version is, as you say, the hard hands, and the outheld hands full of strawberries and cucumbers, and the white sundress, and it's all beautiful. This is life in the country.
Yeah.
And the boy version
Walking.
Is yeah. And the boy version is I'm going to bury some silver coins. I'm going to plant some Jerusalem artichokes. I'm going to have a food forest, and the whole thing will take care of itself. So when I need to bug out with my bug out bag on one shoulder and my zombie hunter supreme machete in the other hand, all of my food and everything will be waiting for me. And you know, the reality is it's a lot of technical skills, and you spend a lot of time looking over herbicide charts to say, okay, I'm trying to get rid of poison ivy, but I don't want to kill off my pasture grasses. There's a lot of, you know, getting your hands dirty and spilling diesel fuel in your face because you're working on the tractor and everything. There was one guy, unfortunately I'm spacing on his name. He's a good mutual on Twitter, and he gave a review of it and said that this is sort of like a really intensely mechanical perspective on things, that it's not, you know, a food forest and frolicking through. So that was the one thing that was most surprising to me. There's a sort of pyramid of infrastructure. And if you have a tractor, an excavator that can do just a huge amount of work in an hour, it could be 500 hours of working with a shovel, but you do it with an excavator instead. And that's great. That's what technology is for. but then you end up doing 5 or 10 hours of greasing the Zerks on the excavator and debugging electrical issues. And so it's still towards the same goal, but you end up finding yourself a little bit, you know, a step or two back. You're using tools to work on your tools. And, you know, I like spinning a wrench, so that's okay with me, but that's the answer to the question. That's what the big surprise was.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a lot more work than people think. I don't think people run towards work usually. Like if they need a job and they just need money, they'll run towards work. Right. But what I mean by that is if it's something you have completely optional in your life and it's a lot of work, you got to love it to actually run towards it. And I think a lot of people run towards it, find out how much work it is and still love it. But it would probably be better if they knew going in how much work it was going to be. Do you have any advice for how to make it not so much work that you decide that sucks and you want to quit? I mean,
yeah,
I remember this dude. He had a channel. I think it was called Cult of Dusty.
Mm-hmm.
He was like, I became a prepper and a homesteader. And he's like, fuck that. I ain't doing it no more. This sucks. He goes, I got chickens and they sucked. And he's like, I got this and that sucked. And like, that's like the only video of his I ever saw, but he had a huge following. I'm like, this is obviously a person who went into it with the wrong mindset, bad information, the wrong expectations, and I'm betting took off way too big of a bite in the beginning.
I think you put your finger exactly on it. And I think we're all tempted to when you don't really understand what's involved. You think, okay, year one is chickens, pigs, turkeys, maple syrup, beehive. Year two is cows and butchering, you know, this other yeah. stuff. And then you realize, you know, I'm here on the farm 12 and a half years in, and I'm about, you know, 1 year through the task list for the first year. And everything not only takes more time, it requires more tools. And you picture yourself, okay, I'm going to get my tractor and I'm just going to be driving along and doing stuff. And you don't realize, like, getting the implement on the back of it with a 3-point hitch is you're going to be like kicking it and trying to get it go. And oh, there's some dirt in there. So now you're scouring it out with a green scrubby and putting some, you know, a grease gun here and there. And, you know, you'll get to the point where you're just driving along all happy. You know, I've been that way with lots of crafts. You know, I've done blacksmithing. I've done wood turning at a lathe. And I love those crafts. But before you know anything, you picture yourself sort of as a master, just, you know, effortlessly hitting or effortlessly, you know, turning on the tool rest. And you'll get there. But it takes a while. So, yeah, I'd say, you know, do what you think is going to be a nibble, and even a nibble is going to be a full-sized bite. So,
yeah. I mean, I know that just the other day, and I don't have a big tractor with a front-end loader or anything like you're talking about. I've just got, like, this little John Deere lawn tractor, mm-hmm. but I've got a really nice trailer I built for myself to haul shit around with. But there's times I need the tractor to be a tractor and mow stuff and do things and go places where, like, it's not good to have a trailer, so you take the trailer off, you drop it, then you back it up and hook it back up. And it's not any big deal. It's just a pin and a, you know, a washer and a cotter pin. But I'm laying in the dirt on my side. It just rained. It's muddy. The ducks are running by shitting next to me. And I'm thinking, I've got to come up with a better way to do this.
Right.
Like, there's got to be another. And I know there is. There's a couple options. But it's one of those things where, like, just do it. But mm-hmm. like, then I got to do the other thing and then this thing and that thing. And then I forgot about it. Kind of like when you walk in a room to get the one thing and then you notice there's a plate. So you put the plate away and, oh, there's dishes in the sink. So you do the dish and you put that on. And then you look around and go, what the fuck was I in here for? And you go sit down. And the second you sit down, you go, oh, yeah, that's what I was supposed to do. So we all have that chronically happen. And I mean, to me, the only way to deal with it as a homesteader is when you decide to start your homestead, figure out the most important first thing you want to do. Do that one thing until it is done, like single word sentence, done, period, to where not only is it finished, and there's nothing else to do to make it work. You've actually used it a while and it does what it's supposed to do. And you found the weaknesses in it and you fixed it. And that one system is finished. Then you're allowed to think about the next thing. And I'm terrible. I like to start shit, right? So, like, I'll have five things started at the same time, none of them done. And it just makes you miserable.
So, you know, I think that's a great point. And it's probably actually for the best, for a reason I'll explain in a minute. It's for the best that stuff takes a little longer than you think. And it's for the best that we don't have infinite money, right? Like if I walked in here with $1 million in my checking account, on day one, I would have said, great,
$5
get it all done. Right. We'll get it all done. I will call in a fencing crew to fence in 50 acres. And, you know, that's, you know, whatever, $400,000.
Yeah.
I'll call in an excavator to do this and that. There's an economics, Hayek, Friedrich Hayek, who talked about local knowledge. And this also ties in with the book Seeing Like a State, which is when you're sitting in D.C. and you're like, you know, the whole country should be more green. We should have more solar panels, or we should do this, we should do that. Like, you don't understand facts on the ground. The person sitting there in D.C. isn't thinking about that. Like, Minnesota and New Hampshire have a lot of snow, and they're not thinking about, you know, this, that, and the other. Whereas those people who are local really know details. So when you land on your homestead the first year, you don't know shit yet. You think you do, but you're really not going to, like, at 5 years in, I was still, like, understanding, oh, this wet area. I'd never thought about it, but it's downhill from here, and it's wet in the spring and the fall, but not in the summer. And you start to learn, you know, sort of real details of the land. And, you know, let's say you're cutting through with your tractor, your riding mower from point A to point B. Only after a while do you realize, oh, there's a shortcut. When I put the fencing in, let me make sure I put a gate here. So going slow sucks because we'd all like to get stuff done and enjoy the fruit of our labor. But on the other hand, going slow lets you build that local detailed knowledge. And then eventually, when you do have the time and the money, come up with the solutions that really make sense, as opposed to being, you know, remote from Washington, D.C. or remote from your poor conception and just sort of doing stuff wrong.
Yeah. You know, there's some real thing you're hitting on there with the local knowledge thing. There's a couple things that makes me think of. One is, like, I always have students come here to do stuff when it's not 1,000 degrees, because I don't want to do things about 1,000 degrees. You know, I make a joke, and it's only half a joke, that by July, hobbits come here and throw rings in the backyard to get rid of them. Like, that's how hot it gets here. So we don't do that's when it's dry, right? So I'll have a student, and these are usually people with some homestead experience, maybe permaculture design certification. Like, these are not uninformed people. And they're sitting here and like, well, this spot here is really wet. Well, that spot's really wet because there's a swell there and it rained 3 days ago.
Yep, yep.
We go 120 days with 1 day of rain.
Mm-hmm.
It ain't wet. It is wet when it's wet.
Right.
Like, and those are different things. So that alone is like, there's a person that's on site looking at a thing
mm-hmm.
that knows way more than any retard in Washington, D.C. doing central planning.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a complete misconception because they looked at it in the moment. And then the other thing that made me think of, I did a really big project for Alcoa on their agricultural buffer land. This was like a 3,000-acre project. And we talked to this old man that had been running cattle out there, and they wanted to make sure he could keep doing what he was doing, even though we were doing what we were doing. There was no problem with it. He was not even touching the capacity of the land. We sat down and listened to this guy for 45 minutes. I do not know what happened to the video of it. It's a shame if it's gone, and it probably is. He starts explaining how he manages cattle. He's basically mostly grass feeding them, but instead of sending them to a CAFO, he's feeding them friggin' candy bars at the very end to fatten uh-huh. before they go to the sale barn.
Right.
But he explains this whole way that he runs these cattle out. And finally, I'm like, well, how much do you guys do annually here? He goes, oh, about $3 million. I said, that's pretty good gross revenue. He goes, no, we do $3 million in profit. And I'm thinking, every one of, like, the starry-eyed rancher, homesteader, wannabe, permaculture, purple-breathing type would say this guy doesn't know what he's doing. But he's the one making $3 million a year.
Right.
Right? I mean, like, and now he had a sweet deal with Alcoa because they needed something done, and he could do the thing that needed to be done. Mm-hmm. But like, there's opportunities like that if you look for them, but without that man specific. Now, could we make that work where they actually made the same amount of money? It might just take longer in between rotations
mm-hmm.
by finishing them all on grass. Sure. But boy, you better understand what's making a profit of $3 million a year before you start touching it. And I know that's not the situation most people run into, but you should think of it that way.
Yeah.
You don't know why things are the way they are until you observe them long enough to to know why it was put that way in the first place. And that local knowledge is just huge.
So on the topic, you know, you're touching on Chesterton's fence. We're talking on local knowledge. And we're talking about sort of, you know, you can even be there a year or two, but the scale is not one weekend where they see the moisture behind the swale. It's a full year. And yeah. Sometimes the scale is much longer. When we first moved here, we got in touch with a guy who owns 150 acres next to us, had him over for coffee. And we mentioned something about the beavers on our property. He said, oh, your beavers are back. And, you know, we thought, oh, we just moved here, you know, 6 months ago or whatever. We thought we had beavers, not they're back.
Yeah.
And he explained, you know, no, they're on about a 10 or 15 year cycle. They, you know, live here. They chew down all of the saplings in their range. Then they move down a river and then back up river in a different direction. And so it's, you know, whatever, 20 or 30 year cycle. So after about 8 or 10 years on the farm, the beavers went away. And so at this point, my wife and I are looking forward. We're like, oh, you know, maybe in another 12 or 14 years, the beavers will come back. And it's kind of neat to sort of deeply understand the land. And we've only been here 12, whereas, you know, he's been next door for, you know, 50. So he really gets it.
Yeah, that's again, it's that the time on land is more important than just being on land. And then those time cycles, like I've been here 14 years and I still learn things about the place from talking to people who've been here. You know, their dad died here.
Yeah.
Right. And that guy's older than me and he's still here. So they know things I don't know, like how this entire development happened, how it all was rangeland at one time.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting way to look at it. There are a lot of people, though, that do kind of romanticize frontier life. From your point of view, what are the real first world systems any system has to get right if it wants to last more than a season or two? So let's kind of go more into that. So we're heading toward your big goal.
Right, yep, I saw you there.
Now we're going to move out on the land, and we're going to, like you said, we don't want to be anarcho-primitivists.
Right.
Like, technology's a good thing. That's why we're not still flipping through the trees and eating bananas, right? So what are the things that, like, if we really want to make things work, we have to get right coming at it from a frontier mindset?
I'll give you my thoughts, which are two big things. And, you know, lots of survivalists, I've been seeing this, you know, for 20 years in Usenet groups and all sorts of discussion online, survivalists and preppers talk about, you know, the most important thing is not a water filter or a firearm. It's a community. And I think that's true. I was in an interview with economist Robin Hanson at an event thrown by the Free State Party, which is not the same as the Free State Project. A different group up here in New Hampshire. And Robin Hanson made the point that passing on learned lessons through speech, i.e. sort of the mechanism of culture, is the super, the killer app, the killer feature of humanity. And there are a few other animals that do it, like orangutan babies live with their mom for 5 or 6 years. And there's all sorts of things that they do not have innately and genetically, instinctually, that they have to learn. They need to be, need to learn to be afraid of snakes. They need to learn how to break open coconuts, sort of using a rock as a tool, et cetera. And, you know, orangutans, you know, some things, you know, fish never know their parents. Orangutans take 5 or 6 years. We, you know, don't become adults until we're 20 or so. But even, you know, as adults, we're still embedded in a culture. We're reading books. We're talking to our grandparents. So I think, you know, when we go to Mars and when we go beyond, we will do it embedded in small cultures. And one thing I'm looking forward to is actually seeing an explosion of cultures in the future. Right now, we're sort of converging more and more to one global monoculture. And I bet you and probably most of the people here aren't thrilled about all aspects of what that monoculture includes. A lot of sort of terrible behaviors and terrible memes and selfishness and short-sightedness. And I think that, you know, frontier values, I mean, one that I love the most is, you know, the best time to plant a tree was 30 years ago. The second best time is today. And my wife and I planted one orchard up at the front of our property, you know, about 10 or 12 years ago. And for about 5 or 7 years, I've been working on a different area, the back of my farm. It had been a farm dump, I think, in the 50s or 70s or something. Then I think in the 90s, they bulldozed the dump flat. They poured a bunch of loads of gravel on top of it to make a landing, which is what they call it in a logging operation. They logged the back 30 or 40 acres, brought that onto the landing, And while they were processing it, all of the bark fell off, covered the gravel, and then hauled it away. And then the forest regrew. So I'm landing here, 12 years back, and there are invasive species, Japanese knotweed, bittersweet, poison ivy, growing up through the dirt, which has got gravel underneath it, which has got tires underneath it, and broken ceramic and boat parts and everything.
Yeah.
So I've been working for about 7 years to kill off all those invasives, dig all the rocks, dig the garbage out and everything, and I've got about 60 apple trees there for making hard cider. And I won't really start harvesting, big quantities of apples for another 5 or 10 years.
Yeah.
But this is, a 10 or a 20 or a 30 year project. And this is, certainly I hope to enjoy some crisp cider from there. But this is really a project for the future generations and, for the people to come after. So that's what being embedded in a culture and a civilization is. And then the second most important thing for a frontier is property rights. I mean, property rights are magical. One problem in a lot of traditional African cultures is that the culture of, and this is in tension with the first one, the culture of family is your cousin gets a windfall. He gets, 50 loaves of bread, and he's hoping to sell these and make a profit and then reinvest. And everyone comes out of the woodwork like, oh, you've got bread. I'm hungry today. I want one of your loaves.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that's great for the one day you get fed. But the incentives are that, no one can ever make a profit. So people just give up. Why would I ever save pennies for a month in order to buy flour to do this? And so everyone lives on the edge of subsistence. So I think that is what the future, whether it's, preppers in the hinterlands in the U.S. or whether we're talking out on Mars in, 90 years. It has simultaneously community plus also property rights.
Yeah, I found that most of the people that are enthused by this idea of like a one world government type of situation or humanitarian monoculture, I think is what you called it. I think that might even be a better way to describe it.
That's great.
Most of them are first world people who think they've traveled because they went to other first world places.
Uh-huh.
Right. And what they've never done is go to a third world place where third world people are in charge and accepted the fact that, no, it's not that way because we made it that way because it's their country and their place that they're in charge of, and seeing what that looks like. And then what you're saying is you want to give them an equal place at the table in deciding how we live. And that incentive concept that you dropped there is incredibly important because there is this romanticization of this like community property mindset and everybody shares that works in kindergarten under the rule of a benevolent dictator called a teacher. And it also works in kindergarten only because you go to school and then you go home. It is a temporary condition for children. And that is the only way that mindset works. And if you I've been to places like Honduras, right? Okay. I've seen places like that run by people that don't get the incentive structure correct. And I'm not even saying we do, we just do it better. Right. And I've always, Charlie Munger, I'm a big fan of his work, and he's always said, you shouldn't question anything until you look at incentives. Where do the incentives lead? And we have a lot of places where incentives lead to failure. The reason it's a failed state is because all the incentives in the state lead to failure.
Yes, I can't disagree with a single thing there. On the topic of the third world, I came across recently a thread that was posted to the internet like 20 years ago. And it was back before, Twitter and Facebook owned everything. It was back when there were lots of little forums and discussion groups. And it was some madman who had decided to travel across Africa in a Range Rover. And this was an insane project. The roads are purely conceptual, just, lines on a map. And in fact, they're, deep, muddy ruts. And it was a disaster. And it was a disaster because of the incentives and because of the cultures that, people there, NGOs would come in, they would pave a strip of road, and all of the locals would sort of immediately start, pulling up the stones and, cutting down the telegraph lines or telephone lines, et cetera. Sort of no sense of time or the importance of moving things along quickly. So, I have not traveled to the third world. And Ben Franklin had a quote, experience is the best teacher, but only a fool learns it, no other. And so I am capable of learning from other people's experiences of the third world. And that, you know, we're way off topic, but that's one of the most important things to defend the civilization that we have. You know, cultures are built by the people in them. The West being a, yes, the West being effectively paradise compared to the standard human condition over the last 10,000 years is not inevitable. We could piss it all away. And, yeah. That's the most important thing, to preserve the Enlightenment, to preserve Western civilization.
Yeah, I think the goal is really to make everybody equal by dragging people that are exceptional down.
Yeah.
Like it's like we, instead of like saying, how do we lift everybody up to their potential?
Mm-hmm.
How do we drag everybody down to equal misery?
Yeah.
And then we'll all be happy somehow.
I think the people pushing these policies, a few are deeply evil. I think most are unrealistic, innumerate, incapable of thinking in anything other but emotions. They feel, they don't think. There's a lot of people out there pushing terrible policies. And you think, like, in a decent civilization, this woman would be a kindly aunt baking cookies for all of the kids and going out on the front porch and handing them to neighborhood kids, because she is just sweet. And so she should be embedded in a culture, in a neighborhood, where she can hand out cookies to the nice little kids running past. But instead, we're in our society, which sadly doesn't love kids, isn't growing. So her concept of handing out cookies is effectively, I should be a good person. I should vote for tax increases so that we can hand out
other
more,
people could hand out
right social services to immigrants. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You're making me think of a conversation I was having one time with a really good friend of mine. And he has a business background a lot like me, which requires a certain amount of authoritarianism, at least in your business. And something came up and his wife and my wife were looking at both of us like we were evil overlords, because we kind of are at times. And I'll remember what his wife said, but she said something and my buddy said, both of you are better people than we are, but the world you live in where you can be that person only exists because of people like us.
Yep. Yep.
And I was like, wow, that's deep and accurate.
Yeah.
Right. Cause like, you know, it basically is like this meme that went around recently, and it was like, you know, global tech or something. It's all women around a conference table. It's like HR people and shit. And they're like, we don't even need men in this company. And then the next thing is like all the shit that was done to build the building and who's doing the work, right? Yep. Like, and it's all dudes. It's like who plumbed it, who brought the cabling in, the electricity in, who walked on the steel while the building was being built, put the glass in 20 stories off the floor. It was all dudes that get shit done. And that's not really like a male-female divide. It just labor seems to work that way.
Yeah.
For some reason, I don't know why.
It's not a male-female divide in the sense that there's no law that says there's no such thing as a female electrician and there's no such thing as a male in HR. But, you know, the tendencies are there.
Yeah, the tendencies are definitely there. You know, but the bigger thing is a lot of those people are like that lady that wants to have the cookie. They believe what they're saying. They're not doing it from an evil standpoint.
Right.
Their experience is so definitively limiting, and then they feel like, well, I have enough. Why don't other people have enough?
Right.
Well, there's reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the reasons you have as much as you do aren't because you're so good. It's because you happen to be blessed to be in a place where that can happen, because some guy went out in the forest and cut down a tree to build the building that you do your work in, and some other guy nearly died mining copper out of the ground and refining it, and some other guy sweated his ass off in a steel mill to make the girders that hold that building up, and some other guy's out on a pole right now, so your internet connection doesn't go down. And it doesn't really matter that they're guys. It matters that somebody else is doing that, and you don't do it, and you don't value the people who do. That's what it seems to me.
100%. You said one minor thing that I want to dig into, because I think it's an interesting launching point and maybe circles us to Red State Mars. So what you said is that you and your other business background buddy I can't help but read when something flashes on the screen. I'll try to look quick. You said that you were kind of authoritarian. I think there's a really interesting point about how societies structure. And I think that, you know, you can't run most things with voting every single person every single time. On the one hand, you need authoritarians to get stuff done. But on the other hand, you don't want a dictatorship where people aren't allowed to leave. So authoritarianism at certain scales is efficient, but you don't want a East Germany scenario where you get shot for trying to leave the authoritarian structure. So there was a philosopher I liked, Robert Nozick, who wrote a great book, Anarchy, State, and Utopia. And, you know, he started with the idea of, like, you know, radical libertarianism, and then said, but, you know, not every group of people would have the same set of norms. And you might find yourself wanting to have a different set of norms. You might even want to bind yourself to certain rules to join another set. So what he worked himself towards was the conclusion that the best society is a collection of lots of little sub-societies. So not a utopia, but a meta-utopia. And I think that's absolutely true. And if you look into history, you end up saying, oh, the Icelandic free state had this thing called Gothis, and you could join one or leave one and have a different set of rules. And a few other people, there is a gray tribe philosopher online, goes by the pen name of Scott Alexander, and he has wrote about I think he called his archipelago, Moldbug had another version. And so that's one of the reasons that I see that, spreading out physically across the U.S., across the solar system, et cetera, is great, because by having lots of different sub-societies, we will have lots of opportunities. And things aren't going to be a free fall in every sub-society. You can't go to Mars, go into, you know, one big dome and say, hey, I've got an inalienable right to shoot my gun whenever I want.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah,
they might say, well, outside you do, but we built this dome and it's somewhat fragile.
Yeah.
And you might go to a Mormon society and say, hey, I want to set up a store that is selling pornography. And they say, you know, you can go 100 miles away, build your own dome and do whatever you want, but we've got social norms here. And so,
my house, my rules thing, like when I was talking about being authoritarian, I don't mean it in the government standpoint. I mean, I'm the guy that every week could give myself a bonus and instead I sign off on the payroll for 1,200 people. That's where I was at the time we were talking about anyway, right?
I ran a company.
So I have every right to be authoritarian with my company that's running on at least as a partner, you know, part of my money and my labor and my direction. And when I told you I wanted this fucking done because I needed to pay those contractors that we have in the Philippines, I meant it.
Yep.
Right. And it was stuff like that we were talking about. It was just the tone of our voice. And it's like, well, you see, the next thing that happens is that person gets fired.
Mm-hmm.
So that was actually benevolence. That was like the last chance that we were talking about. And you're correct. I did not make that person. I don't have the power of conscription. I didn't go out in a field somewhere and throw a lasso around that person and drag them in the building. Mm-hmm. They came to me and asked for a job. I gave them a job. They said they could do it. They did it poorly, and there's a consequence. And when you start talking about, because I want to get into the Mars thing, when you start talking about off-world, like I did a show one time. I don't know if you ever heard it, but it was on the concept of a generational starship. And how authoritarian that would need to be. You're in a giant tube with 10,000 people floating through space for five generations before you get to where you're going. Rigid authoritarianism there because there is a finite resource component.
Yep.
So when we look at Mars, you know, like you're not drilling a well, right? I guess you could set up solar panels, but you better check the day-night ratio there. Mm-hmm, so we probably need a nuclear reactor.
Yep.
You ain't doing it alone. Mm-hmm. If you want to be alone, there's a lot of freaking places you can go build a Unabomber shack in the United States. If you want to go to Mars, at least initially, you're going to live under a big old dome or some shit or in a hole in the ground with skylights or something. I don't know what you're going to do, but you're going to have to do something. You're not just going to go out like you're not going to roll out with a covered wagon in your kin, plow up 40 acres and start making an existence. Mm-hmm. That isn't as easy as people think it is here.
Right.
But you have to get into a different mindset. Is that kind of like I find that we do really good design work with lots of restrictions. That's one of our principles of permaculture.
Absolutely.
I learned with Jeff Lawton.
Yep.
The more restrictions on the design, the more eloquent the design.
Absolutely.
Do you see it that way? Like you take this ultimate restrictive environment and then how do I build the most liberty inside of it?
Yeah. So I agree with you about restrictions triggering creativity, both in the sense of, you know, you're building a barn and the property line is triangular or something, and you will end up getting a much more interesting, unique, and full of character structure than if you just had 100 acres and it was perfectly flat. Because you do that, you're going to pick a big rectangle out of a catalog and you plop it right in the center. But I also agree with that in the sense of structuring, you know, communities and individuals and families. Now, As a fiction writer, you come at this from a different perspective. One problem that a lot of fiction writers have is that they fall in love with their idea and they fall in love with their characters. And there's the concept of Mary Sue. And Mary Sue is when a person says, you know, I'm going to make a character, and this character maybe looks a lot like me, maybe, you know, and she's the best laser shot, and she's the best pilot, and she's the best mechanic, and all this other stuff. And that creates terrible fiction, because we all think we want good things for the heroes, and we do. But what excites us and keeps us reading is watching the heroes almost overcome by events, almost losing. I haven't seen that one. I've only seen the original three. And so you have to do this thing as an author where you create a whole bunch of characters you care about, and they reflect you and your friends and the values of your community. And then you have to screw them over. You have to make them outnumbered. You have to make the weather turn bad. The last match gets knocked out by the snow. And so that is tangential to what you're saying about constraints, but it is constraints in making your art resonate with people, because people want to watch underdogs barely survive rather than watch them waltz right into something.
Yeah. Yeah. For people that are not on the video side, when he was talking about a Polly Sue, I said Rey in Star Wars, which was the character in like the next generation of Star Wars and all. And yeah, it instantly can use a lightsaber, use the force. Like, and it was just so ridiculous. And the only reason I knew the term Polly Sue is because I heard somebody talk about that from that angle. And I've expanded that. There's Polly Sam's too.
Mary Sue, yeah.
Right? A Mary Sue, that's what it's. A Mary Sue, right? A Mary Sue or a Mary Sam. They can do everything perfectly with no real explanation of why. There's a TV show we watch, a cop show called The Rookie, and they tried to do this crossover, and they brought this chick in. It was like a 50-year-old guidance counselor joining the FBI, and she'd solve every – it was ridiculous, and it obviously didn't work, because even in that stupid genre of TV show, people were like, no, this doesn't make any sense. And you're right. People like to see the – if you're going to have a story of survival, a story of conflict, a story of anything like that – if the person walks through like Superman, it's boring.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And this is the reason politicians make up bullshit about how hard their life was when it never was.
Mm-hmm,
because there's nothing tangible in a narrative of Bill grew up in a great home. He went to a good school. He met Sally. They got married, had three kids, and lived happily ever after.
Mm-hmm.
Who the fuck would buy that?
Right, right.
Who would read that? Who would want to watch a movie like that? Nobody would. So, and it's the other reason is not just because it's boring. It's because it's not realistic. And all this talk about colonizing Mars or even the moon, if you don't think people are going to die, you know, like you don't understand it at all. Like, think of how many people died coming here from Europe.
Just absolutely.
Right out of the gate. And not because some Indian hit them in the head with a tomahawk or some shit. Like, they showed up. They ran out of food. And they starved to death. They ran out of food mostly. They didn't have enough food to get enough nutrition, so they got sick and they died. They got stung by a mosquito, got malaria, and died. Like, this is in the tens of thousands in the beginning years of settlement. And there's water here. There's food here. There's oxygen here. What does that all look like if we try to go frontier Mars?
Yeah. That's a great question. And so, I think in actual practice, when Elon Musk starts landing starships there and, you know, 6 months on what his announced schedule is, or, you know, 10 years, more realistically, his projects work on the same schedule as homesteading does. You know, I'll have it done by Christmas. And then 9 years later, you're like, it's almost done. So I think in real life, there will be deaths, there will be setbacks, but I think it's going to proceed somewhat reasonably. If I can give a plot precis of Red State Mars, I was talking to Tony, who is the lead editor at ARC, the publisher, and Tony approached me and he said, hey, I've read your Aristotle's books. I love them. They were sort of very libertarian, sort of very gray tribe and intellectual. I'm thinking about a book by you that is a little more red tribe, you know, a little more rooted in America as opposed to sort of a bunch of, you know, intellectual libertarians on the moon. So we talked it out and I thought, you know, okay, this is interesting. There's something here. And what cinched it for me was coming up with the conflicts, and there's external conflicts and internal conflicts. And on the internal conflict, well, I'll do the external conflicts first. It's all set. It assumes that there is a nuclear and biological war, in 2050. And this is, a generation or two after that, some people escape. from the Midwest, and the nuclear and biological war mostly hits the cities. So it really changes the culture of America by removing the blue. And you know, a lot of people probably listen to this like, right on, like, all right, now I've got my ideal society. Yes and no. You know, that screws things up, and you get a bit of a road warrior situation. And so then some factions end up fleeing that and going to Mars. And then at Mars, they eventually run into Chinese who also flee to Mars. And so you've got these two groups of refugees. There's American refugees and Chinese refugees. And they get along acceptably well with each other. They're both out on the frontier, just trying to get away from all of the wreckage back home. Yeah. But then their problems back home end up following them out there. And so we know in real life that the Chinese government says, oh, there are these overseas Chinese and they should be loyal to the home government. So when we mm-hmm. ask them to do some reconnaissance intel for us, they should. When we ask them to do this, they should. And so we get into that sort of situation where the overseas Chinese on Mars are getting pressure to behave in a certain way. And the Chinese successor state is asserting itself. And you've also got these effectively Texans on Mars. There we go. Who are just trying to live their own lives. So that's the external conflict, and that conflict gets pretty severe. It's, you know, effectively all out war. But then there's also internal conflict, and there is a great book that came out probably 20 years ago called Albion's Seed. And Albion's Seed is, I think the subtitle is Four American Folkways. And it makes the point that, you know, in England around 1700 or 1600, there were 10 or 12 or whatever subcultures. Four of these subcultures were heavily involved in settling the eastern seaboard of the U.S. You had the Puritans who settled Massachusetts. You had the second child and, you know, younger son aristocracy who were never going to inherit lands back home. And so they came overseas to Virginia, et cetera, to effectively LARP as aristocrats. And they got African slaves and dressed them up in European peasant clothes and taught them traditional folk songs so that they could pretend to be European peasants. You had Quakers who were sort of nonconformists and pacifists settling in Pennsylvania. And then finally, you had the Scots-Irish, who are from the sort of battered warlike culture up on the northern borders. And they also landed in Virginia, at which point the very civilized and well-to-do Virginians said, we don't need your type here. Keep moving along. Go west. Why don't you go up in the Appalachians where the land is terrible, not at all good for growing tobacco or cotton, and there's lots of Indians. You deal with that, not us. And so, and then just as an aside there, you take Scots-Irish who've been living in a state of war for 300 or 400 years, you bring them to America, you stick them on terrible land and put them in a state of war again. And that is, to some degree, how America built its warrior caste. And this is still a population that's like 75% of all our armed forces. So anyway, once you start looking at America through this lens, you start to understand, oh, Massachusetts is a direct, in the current year, is a direct descent from the Puritans and the way they behave and the way they enforce ideological orthodoxy on people, the way they expel people who are nonconformists. This is not something that developed in the 1970s with the hippie movement. This is a 400-year-old set of cultural norms. And the Scots-Irish, the drinking and hell-raising and to some degree broken families because people sometimes don't have as much conscientiousness as they should. This is, again, a 400 or 500-year-old story. So first of all, read Albion's Seed. It's a great book. But then when I was talking to Tony about Red State Mars, I had this idea, okay, internal conflicts where you have Martian colonies that are not culturally unified, where you have some gray tribe libertarians from the Pacific Northwest, sort of your typical FANG engineer, and you've got old money Texans, and you have some Scots-Irish, and you've got some of this, you've got some sort of Baptist holy rollers or Bible thumpers, having all of these people who don't get along well with each other, but they all share the same common enemy. So you've got these external conflicts, but also you can't help but annoy and bug each other with misunderstandings and conflicts. So that was the big thesis behind Red State Mars. And one minor footnote to that, if anyone's aware of sort of neo-reaction, which was one of the bases of the New Right 15 or so years ago, there was a blog post by a guy going by the name of Spandrel, and he said, hey, neo-reaction is three different overlapping sets of people. You have sort of old school racial essentialists. You have techno commercialists. These are the kind of like Peter Thiel, someone who might work at James Street or one of the AI companies. And the third group was Theonomist. And so these are three overlapping groups that in the year 2010 in America were making up some of the new right. So what I did in Red State Mars was use those sets of people. Instead of the four tribes of Albion Seed, I used these three tribes of 2010's American neoconservatism, and then wrote a novel around that. So this is not some huge nerd essay. It is a rollicking sci-fi adventure with missiles and...
We just lost audio on you. I don't know if you can hear me. We lost audio on you.
I am back. I think I
tapped. There you go. All right.
Sorry about that. So anyway, this is not some, you know, long nerd essay. It is a rollicking high-tech space adventure with lots of combat. But there is that layered in sort of the under the slab or the basement of the whole story if you care to look for it.
Yeah. Here's an interesting thing. I kind of skimmed the book. I didn't have time to read it. It's a pretty big book as it is. We did get it about a week ago, I guess. So I got kind of some gist of it. But one of my things with the whole combat concept is that has to look a lot different on a place where if somebody cracks your dome, you're all dead.
Right.
Right. Yeah. So in a warfare here on planet Earth, if you bomb the hell out of a city, a surprising number of people crawl out from the rumble and put things back together way quicker than you think they would. If you mm-hmm. look at things like the Battle of Britain, right, and then the retaliatory bombing of Berlin and how many people actually survived, and how many people, like, they blow everything up and they go back. Well, that's not happening
right
in this scenario. I mean, I guess if you have underground structures to a degree, but it seems like an incredible vulnerability, which you would think would be some level of deterrent to war. Or does it create like this kind of agreed upon thing, like,
right,
we won't crack your, like, there's even in conflicts, serious global conflicts mm-hmm. of our past, there are certain things one side doesn't do because the other side's going to do it. Like, we all had nuclear weapons during, like the Vietnam War. It was a proxy war that we were, but we didn't start lobbing H-bombs at each other.
So you asked a question, and then you came up with, like, my three answers.
Okay.
Like, is it A, right, or is it B, or is it C? Like,
yeah, it's all
very,
those.
Very smart, because you put your finger on a lot of it. To some degree, when people fight, I mean, in the Bronze Age, most of wealth was in the form of, like, you know, bronze and horses and women and coins. And yeah, so you could go in and you could burn an entire city and you could kill everybody. But at the end of the day, if you walk out with like three chests of coins and a whole bunch of slaves on a rope, you've taken all the wealth there was. But as we've gotten more sophisticated, the form of wealth has gotten less transportable and sort of more embedded in the network of things. So,
yeah,
you know, if, you know, you don't want to ideally, you know, just smash your enemy and take over his coal mines. I mean, what percent of the U.S.'s value is the value of the coal in it? It's really the value of the corporations and the culture and this and that. So, you know, China would far rather prefer to wage war by buying off our politicians than it would to, yeah, you know, just knock everything flat. And then you also raised another excellent point, which is also part of the answer, which is once you cross a threshold, you encourage the other side to cross a threshold. And so we had chemical warfare in World War I, and we all came out of that saying, let's not do that again. And all sorts of conflicts since then, you would think the losing side would say, all right, we've almost lost, you know, in the Gulf War or other wars, we've almost lost, let's break out the phosgene gas. And the answer is, it's actually probably better to just lose political control than it is to cross that threshold and have your own population, hammered in the same way.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I mean, if I'm on Mars and I'm at war with this other group of people that have their base,
mm-hmm.
their wealth is the base itself.
Right.
If I blow it up, I get nothing.
Right. And you blow it up or even deflate it rapidly and three quarters of them die. You would rather, the Soviet Union at the end of World War II, their strategy, you know, there's a book, I think Passage Press just put it out, Stalin's Great Raid. I've got a copy of it sitting on the kitchen table downstairs. And it talks about how the Soviets were just totally economically incapable. And they had the revolution, and the first thing they did is broke open all of the vaults and seized all of the wealth and seized all of the factories. And so that was a huge infusion of capital. And so they did great for 10 or so years with all of the stolen wealth. And then even by, 10 years later, things were petering out. World War II, they had another great raid. They took all of Eastern Europe, and they just dismantled, entire German factories and shipped stuff back east on rail cars. But once they had fully internalized that, they ran out of impetus again. So I think that's, gets to what we're talking about, that a lot of the value of something is when it is complete and functioning. You don't want to just smash it to pieces.
Yeah, yeah. Because I'm just thinking of like some of the things I've seen as plans on how to colonize the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And one is to take the Starship and lay it on its side.
Yep.
And remove the fuel tanks because you don't need them once you're there. Mm-hmm. And then you create all this living space. And
yep.
That all sounds great. And yeah, it's pretty heavy duty piece of equipment, but making a hole in it wouldn't be all that hard.
Right, right.
And once you have one hole, everything goes to shit really fast.
Right.
So, like, it's a new level of, like, the nuclear option and what that actually looks like.
So, on the topic of colonizing the moon, just as a brief technical aside, my first two novels were The Powers of the Earth and Causes of Separation, which were about colonizing the moon and then getting in a fight with the United Nations. But on the technology of using Starship, Skylab, which you and I are old enough to remember
yes.
from the late 70s, Skylab was originally designed as what's called a wet lab. And this is you take the third stage of a Saturn V, and the each stage of a rocket is basically just a couple of tanks inside, one for the oxidizer, one for the propellant.
Yeah.
And you can inside there put in a floor in the form of a grid, like a catwalk grid, and the fuel can go right through that. And then once you're up in orbit and you've used that fuel and used your rockets, you can have a airlock or a door already built in, open that and get inside. So as it turned out, they ended up launching Skylab without fuel in it. So it was a dry lab instead of a wet lab. And so I expect that Starship upper stages will be used in a similar way. You said take the tanks out. No, leave the tanks in. They're perfect. They're already sealed against pressure. Yeah. Take the liquid oxygen, burn up all the liquid oxygen, and then just put in, air.
It's just a second shield is what
yeah.
it really is. So why would you take it away?
Right. Now,
these are videos being made by people using AI on
yeah. Yeah.
On YouTube that are taking the actual thing and extrapolating what it might look like.
Yep.
But yeah, I'm back to it. It could be pretty easy to damage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be, and they're actually saying like on the moon, they're going to have to bury it.
Right.
And one way or another, you have to bury it. They're talking about like shit you never even think of, like when they land a rocket, the dust. And so they're talking about like melting the dust into basically hard packed glass so that mm-hmm. their landing pads, because otherwise you have to haul freaking concrete to the moon, and that
right.
doesn't really look like the water alone, right? You need the water for people and to make more rocket fuel. As I look at all this, I go, this is all doable, but it also sounds a lot like the bullshit. You talk about Skylab. I remember being in like second grade in Catholic school, and they were teaching us about Skylab. And they were talking about how we were going, by the time we were grown up, and I don't know if you noticed, I got a little bit of gray on me now.
Cool.
So I done did the growing up part.
Yep.
We would have the space cities rotating around the, orbiting the Earth, and that we would have gravity in them because they would be like this disc, kind of like Deep mm-hmm. Space Nine is, except it would spin. And that would, you'd actually be walking on what you would think of as the sides.
Right.
That centrifugal force would create artificial gravity. And they even brought up, and I thought this is interesting looking back at it now, and I completely forgot about this, the idea that some of those space cities may decide they don't want to be part of Earth anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, in your second grade mind, Earth means United States because we run everything and control mm-hmm. it. This is the 1980s, right? This is like Reagan just got elected, hadn't sworn in yet. That's dating this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we, as kids, couldn't even conceive, like, well, maybe they have a right to, but why would you not want?
Right.
Right? Like, and then we had this, we did get into an, even at that age, got into some level of discussion, but then how would they get stuff? Like, would they actually be able to provide all their individual needs? You know, and the teachers are like, oh, just use sunlight and grow plants. And we're all thinking, this is the 80s again. I ate steak last night. I don't know about you. Like, mm-hmm. how is this all going to work? You know, and they told us we could live on milk. That was bullshit. But it was closer to the truth than what they tell us we can live on today.
Mm-hmm.
But what this brings me to is kind of the next question I have for you anyway. How do we get into discussions and look at, like, how do engineering realities, repair culture, local production shape whether a society stays free or becomes dependent on, like, distant authorities? Because we start if we actually do start colonizing Mars, it's going to be a long time before they don't need a lot of fucking resupply.
Right, right. And so I am very interested in economics and very interested in concepts of trade and all these other things. And I saw something go by on Twitter just this morning. It was talking about one problem that held the Mormon pioneers back when they first settled the Salt Lake area was that Joseph Smith had ideas about autarky, which is we should be self-sufficient. We shouldn't import things. And of course, there is gains from trade, and there are gains from specialization and division of labor. So it is likely the case that in, you know, I don't know my Mormon timeline perfectly good, so I don't know if we're looking at 1830 or 1870 or something. But even with all of the cost to haul stuff across the Great Plains behind a bunch of horses, there are going to be things, clocks or copper pots or whatever, where you are in fact better off trading back to Boston or back to Virginia or to get that rather than do it sort of very poorly and very inefficiently out there. So yeah, when we land on Mars, you know, I mean, we're not autarkic in North America at this point. There's all sorts of stuff that, yeah, we could do, but why not buy it from Japan? Why not, you know, get our, whiskey from Scotland in addition to, you know, our bourbon, domestically. And so I think that there will always be trade. And what you touched on a few things that are very near and dear to my heart. You were gesturing towards sort of right to repair and your ability to fix your own equipment. And that ties into, you know, homesteading and, you know, escape the city and everything, which is if you can't work on your own tractor, you know, if you have to send back to Earth and, get a part shipped out 2 years later, that is a big delay. So I think that, one thing that's really helpful is the rise of 3D printers and a lot of other, small scale fabrication. And there's just amazing things with CNC machines, et cetera. And I think that we will probably see a lot of sort of intentionally slightly low tech designs being used on Mars. Because yeah, okay, it could be 10%, 20% more efficient or cheaper or this or that. But if it requires some hyper specialized, you know, trillion transistor chip that only comes from Earth, we'd rather have one that wasn't quite as good, but can be maintained with a ball peen hammer and a screwdriver. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one of the things though with the trade is, you've got a Mars you can trade with. I mean, eventually, sure, you get enough people involved and, you know, you have the luxury as a fiction writer of advancing timelines on a timetable and jumping 50 years ahead to this thing's been built or whatever. But if you compare that to like the frontier culture of settling North America, I've seen a lot of discussions how the Native Americans could have driven us out, how they could have won, et cetera. Well, long term, I don't think it was going to happen.
No.
It was going to, but you know, if you had pushed it back 100 years and you didn't have to come up with a great battle plan,
right?
All they had to do was nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you look at the, and I think a lot of people don't understand the original dynamics between European settlers and Native Americans. Both of them thought that they could control the other side. If somebody wants to understand this history, I cannot recommend highly enough 1491 America before Columbus and 1493 America after Columbus to understand this dynamic. But without Native American involvement, Jamestown, everybody dies. Plymouth, everybody dies, right? Those toll holds never happened. Yes, they could have overrun them, but all they really had to do was nothing. There was trade all up and down the Atlantic coast. There were places that the Europeans couldn't put their boat ashore. But the natives wanted what the Europeans had, and the Europeans wanted what the natives had, so they would come out in their, like, skinned boats and shit and do trade.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes, people being people, natives took Europeans prisoner and put them in enslavement and took them off their boats, and there were exactly the other thing happened where they would grab natives because they were a novelty back in Europe and throw them down in the hold and take their shit and take them back to Europe and enslave them. Right. And like, so if they would have just said, we're not going to have anything to do with you, it would have been very difficult for these people, at least initially, that first like 50 years of toehold settlement, to get anywhere without that assistance that was seen by both sides as we'll take advantage of them.
Right, right.
And we so devalue those people. We talk about all this romanticism about Native Americans and the way of the red man and shit, but the idea that they were completely oblivious dupes in this whole thing. They had a very, in some instances anyway, a very negative view of Europeans, but not like, oh, these dirty people are coming here. More like they don't know what they're doing. Their boats can't turn on a dime. Their clothes are dog shit. They die in the woods really easily. They don't know how to hunt. They don't know how to fish. They don't know how to do things, right? And so they looked at us as being incompetent and didn't understand the technology underneath it. But that whole dynamic worked because there were people on both from both sides. You go into space, there's no corner store.
You're right.
And there's nobody to barter wampa with, right? Like you got to start from nothing.
I agree. And so, you know, when you talk about trade, and I've thought about this a lot, you know, to write fiction, let me back up. And like when I was 13 or 14 and I'm playing Dungeons and Dragons and I'm designing my own dungeons, and I'm thinking like a whole bunch of rooms, one connected to the next, doesn't make sense. Like, do these monsters just sit there? No, they need exits where they can come out, where they can get food. You know, why? What's happening? So I've got, you've probably seen the blue hat, you know, please have patience. I've got autism or something. Friends got me one of those. So I literally have that hat. And so when I'm writing science fiction, I do the same thing. I want to think, you know, what are these people producing? Why are they there in the first place? And it's important to realize that one of the big reasons that America was settled, the French settled for economic reasons, and they didn't make that much of a lasting impact on the continent. The English settled for cultural reasons. They were religious fanatics. They were cultural fanatics. They wanted to get away and have exit. And so I think that is going to be probably the big motivator in the early, you know, in the first century of anything that we do out in the solar system. The people who go to Mars are going to be nutcases for some ideology, not there to pick up pretty rocks that they can trade for microprocessors. And so early days of colonization require, they are sinks for resources. You're just pouring money in and not getting anything out. But then eventually you start getting stuff out and there will be trade. So I think that the trade will exist in the early days, but it will be trade of savings of the people who want to create a new, I don't know, Jewish separatist state or Muslim. Well, actually, I don't think Muslims are going to go, you know, get their act together and go to space. But you can imagine lots of different first world subcultures. And I think that will be catalyzed off of savings and capital. And then eventually in time, they will specialize in certain things and there will be robust trade.
Now, I mean, let's think about what are the countries that can do something like this if they really wanted to now, like even if we take Mars off the table first, say moon's first step,
right?
China
and the U.S.
That's the U.S. India. I know they sent a rocket to the moon and all, but actually the logistics of the entire thing. No, Russia. No. Russia's in a population demographic decline bomb. Any of the countries you would say, like the English, or only because they're riding on us, like we'd have to give them a ride, like the French, come on, like the entire EU, they're too busy trying to tax apple peels or some shit. Anybody south of the United States, South America, the global south, no.
Yep.
Japan. No,
their population shrinking. Yeah, I think it's just the U.S. and China, and that is the entire plot of Red State Mars. Yeah, Americans.
I mean, Japan could go with us. They could send some people along, but they're not going to actually lead that initiative. They're not going to have like the American zone, the Chinese zone, the Japanese zone. That's not going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't like I think people have too much microwave mindset, is what I call it, and they think this is way easier than it is.
Yeah,
and it ain't. It's however hard you think it is on the day you think it's the hardest, multiply that by 1,000.
Yeah.
Even Elon Musk, who is this visionary, like somebody proposed some concept on some discussion on X one time and said, how could humans make a civilization on Venus? And his entire response was, with great difficulty.
Yes, yes.
Dude, you just described your own dream. Like, that's an impossibility.
Right.
Right. You're doing with great difficulty. You know, I just think he was trying to make a point. Like, if there was somebody trying to make a point, it would be an easier planet to terraform and lighten.
And you know, even terraforming. Well, on the one hand, I want to say, you know, it's centuries or millennia out. But the other weird thing is how GDP growth and technological growth, et cetera, is compounding. And so, you know, we tend to think of it as sort of linear. But if we have, let's say that the GDP grows on average, maybe 2% a year. But those numbers compound over time. So, you know, I was arguing with someone on Twitter, because that's what I do with my life, arguing with someone on Twitter about standard of living at various times. And I looked up the per capita GDP in 1950 and in the U.S., and it was insanely low, something like $5,000 per person. In constant dollars, even dealing with inflation. And today it's, you know, 5 or 10 times that. And that's because you just have this growth compounded and compounded. And especially now with AI seeming to be near takeoff and a few other things, there are things that, you know, might have struck us in 1980 as, oh, that's going to take 1,000 years to do. Maybe it happens in 50 years. I don't know. So
I'm with you on that. There are things that we will have exponential leaps on.
Yep.
Back in 2012, I think the first time I said that the decade between 2020 and 2030 would be the greatest decade of flux any living humans ever seen. And all I've done with that timeline is I shifted it 5 years and said it's 25 to 35.
Yeah. So
I think COVID kind of put a wrinkle in my prediction, honestly.
So on the topic of decade of growth, there is a thing that comes from economics called Kondratiev waves. And thank you. And this is an idea that there are business cycles, and, you know, maybe the typical business cycle is like 3 years long, but then there is a sort of bigger business cycle. And I'm going to make up a terminology just to get the point across. It's like the debt cycle, which is 12 years. And then there's these other cycles. And from time to time, these cycles will all sort of hit simultaneously. And the idea is pretty well established at the small scale, and it's a bit more speculative at the middle scales. And I thought very deeply about this. And started thinking, you know, I think that there is to some degree, that there's a book by Strauss and Howe called Generations, and it's got some subtitle, and it's often called Generations Theory. And this is the idea that there is a cultural sort of 80 or 100-year cycle where you have one generation that goes through deep privation, and this might be the silent generation or the greatest generation. And this turns into effectively, this is the academic version of the meme of bad times make hard men make good times make soft men make bad times. So you have these four different generations, and each of them starts where it is, changes the world in some way, changes the conditions on the ground for the next generation, and then the next generation in turn is born into a new world and has a new set of reactions and behaviors. And so yes, fourth turning is related to this, but also Generations : the subtitle is there too. And so, you know, I think that there are cycles that are like 500 years long. So the Westphalian nation state system is about 500 years old. Gutenberg's press is about 500 years old. And so you see the change from feudalism to modernity broadly around 1500 AD. You see the turn from the Dark Ages to feudalism at 1000. You see the end of the Roman Empire in falling into the Dark Ages at around 500. And so I started playing with this idea, you know, 15 or 20 years ago. And I was thinking at that point, wow, we've got the internet and the World Wide Web is coming, and it seems that stuff is accelerating. And I think that, and I think that we are, in our generation, in our time, and over the next 25, 30, 40 years, living through one of the most fundamental changes in human civilization that our species gets to see, like, every 500 years. And I think we're in for some extraordinarily weird times. You know, just the rise of peptides, the weight loss drugs, and there are all sorts of other related things. I know some people online, fitness bros, using the Glow Stack or the Wolverine Stack and repairing tendon damage. There's a guy I follow on Twitter, really smart guy, Cremu, I think that's how you pronounce his handle, and he's talking about there's a new drug coming out right now that might end heart disease and arterial plaque. And AI and data centers are really, you know, helping with this, helping us develop drugs at 10 times the rate. So I think we're in for some absolutely wild times, we're all going to see civilization on Mars, you know, in the relatively near future.
Yeah. The book itself, Red State Mars, is a work of fiction, but listening to you talk, it sounds like the political and economic questions in it are anything but fictional.
Yep.
What can people learn from speculative fiction that sometimes they miss in ordinary policy talk?
Oh, that's a great question. There are so many things in politics where the Overton window is about 3 inches wide. And that Overton window is breaking down right now. Like, we were really stuck in an Overton window from, I don't know, 1950 to 2010, right? Everybody agreed on absolutely everything. The question was, should the income tax be 29% or should it be 31%? The question was, should the public schools be funded at $15,000 a year or $16,000 a year? The question is, should civil rights be enforced through affirmative action in hiring or merely affirmative action in education? And, you know, a lot of people talk about, oh, the uniparty, everyone agrees on the exact same thing. I think Obama tried to accelerate the communist revolution. He tried to accelerate the Gramscian long march through the institutions. And he pushed too far, too far and too fast, and broke the system. But the system was going to break anyway, because, you know, we're hitting this every 500 years thing. Trump came back pushing in the opposite direction. And, you know, sort of further broke the system. And everyone on the left is like, oh, look at Trump, who broke all of the norms. Like, oh, Trump broke all of the norms. Like, you know, the norm that USAID gets to funnel infinite money to leftist agitation groups, a norm that was 11 years old or 12
years
old.
Yeah. That's norm. Right. The norm of sending money through USAID for transgendered operas in North Ireland, because that's a necessary function of the United States government. Yeah, that norm.
So I forget what your question was. I just got headed off on a rant.
Well, I was just basically saying, like, there's a lot of things inside of your work.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Are not fictional, but yeah. Fiction often helps us learn what we can't learn from looking at factual.
Right. And so that is where I was going, which is, if you want to think, how does the world operate? You look out your window, you look at the front page of the New York Times or the front page of National Review or whatever. And the Overton window is very narrow, and you only get to see, you know, it's like looking out through your front window with the curtains drawn. You get to see just this much, and you don't get to see what's offstage to the left and offstage to the right. But, you know, sort of as you get closer to this curtain, it gets wider. And so as we travel, you know, sort of forward in time and the possibilities open up, the only way to get a preview of possibilities is to play around with ideas. And, you know, I could have, sat here and wrote a 900-word essay on Strauss-Howe generation theory and Kondratiev waves and, Ricardian comparative advantage and all of these other things. But, you know, probably one person in 1,000 wants to read that. And so I personally think that, you know, my calling is to explore some of these really fascinating ideas that do explain how the world works and the possibilities that they might give rise to, but do it in the guise of a story about guys with rifles and robots and 3D printers and other stuff in space.
Yeah, I think that one of the reasons that people can learn so much from fiction is because they open their mind.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if I'm reading a book on a colony on Mars, I don't expect everything to, like, there is like the stereotypical nerd comic book guy at the convention pushing his glasses up saying, you know, you said this in episode 137, but then you said, like, there is that person. But most people are like, this is going to be fun. Like, I'm going to have to suspend some things to be able to watch this. How can a starship travel at 1,000 times the speed of light? Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter. It does in the story. So the very fact that the mind has been opened that way means that information that it would generally repel due to cognitive dissonance, it will allow in. It like opens the filter a little wider and lets new ideas in, and then a person can process it. I also think that's why the left tends to try to leverage it to sell things like one world government. And it's, you know, diversity for the sake of diversity, et cetera. Which, you know, all the places they want to go to for diversity tend to not be very diverse. They want to, I want to experience diversity. I'm going to go to an Indian reservation. You know, you can see there one tribe. or I'm going to go to this place. Well, this place is going to be all people of this race or this sect or this color or whatever. Like, that's not diversity. That's actually unity. And you don't know what you're looking at, because you're looking at it through a bullshit filter. Where if maybe you get them to look at it through a reality filter, and I think that's what you can kind of do, is you can kind of make a swap there. Since now I'm open to things that I would generally say that can't happen, then the other ideas actually get in, then the mind can actually process them, and then it can work out, well, what actually do I take away from this that is the lesson, like the fox and the grapes. Well, the fox doesn't talk, but we learn from the parable, right? Yeah. We learn from the fable. That's what I'm saying.
Humans are a social species, and you know, we evolved in small tribes. And in a small tribe, there was a great book. I think it was called The Third Chimpanzee. And it made the point that at a certain point in our intellectual development, the selective pressure that operated to see whether someone would survive and reproduce became less poisonous snakes and cold winters and saber-toothed tigers, and more how well you fit into the social structure. Mm. Because if you open your mouth, you say the wrong thing, you get ostracized, you get left behind on the Siberian plain, your fitness goes down. And so the author of that book posited this runaway effect where we're all effectively playing poker. We're bluffing each other. We're trying to figure out when he says that Sally is a nasty hoe, does he really believe that and I should agree with him, or is he feeling me out so that when I agree, he can then go tell Sally and Sally is, you know, bah, 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 bah. And so that, you know, and there is this exponential curve on the size of brains in hominids over the last 100,000 or 300,000, or whatever years. And brains are not cheap. They're metabolically super expensive. A disproportionate amount of the calories we burn every day is burned by our brains just keeping themselves alive. And so the thing, we have evolved into the structure of our brain, effectively like coprocessors. You know, there's graphic coprocessors on a CPU. We have coprocessors that are all about social stories, because that is a survival function, to understand how people interact. So we do not necessarily have coprocessors for math or for economics or whatever. So if you want to play with these ideas, the best way to do it is to tell enticing, exciting tales about people and people in conflict with each other. And, you know, we have the Odyssey and the Iliad. So, you know, for 4,000 years or more, you know, the oldest books of the Old Testament date back to about the same era, and they're Chinese things. Telling stories about people in conflict and people rubbing up against each other. And you see this, you know, in the Greek gods. We could sit here and write a disquisition on, you know, how exactly does rational thought interface with emotions, and instead we can just, you know, read a Greek or Roman tale of Apollo and Aphrodite, because, you know, it's all there. So I think that's what fiction is ideally doing. It's operating at two levels at the same time. It's telling exciting human tales of battle and action, but it also has in the undertext or the understory thoughts about aspects of the human condition.
Yeah. You've approached this from two distinctively different angles. One, as an author of science fiction, examining frontier culture, human conflict, all of that, but also in your own, you know, microcosm in the real world of leaving a kind of professional, somewhat urban life and going out and homesteading.
Mm-hmm.
In that, if someone's listening to my show and they want to be more resilient now, what practical habits, systems, or skills would you tell them to build first if they want more real sovereignty in their life?
Excellent.
Sovereignty is what we're really talking about here.
So I've got two answers, and it's sort of the alpha and the omega. It's like the first chapter of Escape the City and the last chapter of Escape the City, 1,400 pages later. The first one is, hey, you want to move out to the country in a year or two. What do you start doing now? And I go into that, like, you know, the time to acquire skills and tools is now, because you ideally want to land maybe not 100% on your feet. You're not going to know how to maintain a tractor on your first week on the homestead. But it would be good if you already had a socket set and knew how to swap a new carburetor onto your lawnmower. That'll be a good platform. You can then figure out how to install a diesel lift pump on your tractor, or you can do some other stuff. Now is the time to take a welding class at the local community college. Also, you know, to some degree, get your social life squared away. There are not a huge number of eligible young bachelorettes or bachelors in the countryside. So it would be good if you could, you know, meet the person you're going to spend some time with through, you know, the folk music scene or through, you know, dancing or through your ultimate frisbee club or something. You know, there are people out here, but it's sparse. That's part of the point of the country. So there's a lot fewer of them. And not a lot of people, if they're not from here, work that angle up. The second thing, is what to prepare for, as you say, sovereignty. And I would say, you know, sort of risk mitigation, et cetera. We were talking before about Kondratiev waves and how some things happen every 3 years, you know, plus or minus some things happen every 12, some things happen every 500. I wrote Escape the City back before COVID, and in the final essay, the essay is called Prepping and the Power Law. And the Power Law is a statement that says that the bigger a deal something is, the less frequently it happens. So, you know, how often is there a robbery in your town? Once a week. How often is there a murder? Once every 3 years. How often is there a serial killer or a murder spree? Once every century. How often is there a genocide? Like genocides, you know, happen all over the world, but they don't happen that often, you know, every 200 years. Or talk about the size of cities. The power law applies again. There's a million hamlets of 10,000 people. There's a few cities this, you know, you get down to cities of size 1 million, you get down to world cities of 20 million. There's only a handful of these things. Mm-hmm. So when you talk about situations that are going to affect you in your life, you get into a power law. And everyone is interested in prepping for the sexy ones. Everyone wants to prep for World War III. They want to prep for the zombie uprising. They want to prep for, you know, a civil war. Now, these things do happen. People lived through civil wars in Yugoslavia. People have lived through, et cetera. But here is a low damage but ultra high probability. There will be a recession in the next 10 years. You will get laid off. So, you know, you got to go Dave Ramsey. The best thing you can do is just have an emergency fund to get your personal finances squared away.
Gotcha. Go ahead.
Oh, and so, you know, because that's going to happen in the next 3 or 5 or 8 years. The next thing to do is start addressing lower priority things. You know, have a first aid kit. If you have a tourniquet, you might cut yourself pretty badly, which isn't the same as saying, you know, you need to have a surgeon on staff in your home. It's not the same as saying you need to have NBC protective gear. So the more you can concentrate on very likely to happen things, the more you can lower risk and increase sovereignty in your life. So I would not focus on the zombie uprising as the scenario.
Yeah, and I always caution people with this idea, this fantasy shit they have, that life will be better after these this apocalypse that they keep seeing. That, you know, those people that lived through it, like in Bosnia and whatever, their lives didn't get better after it was over. It got better than it was during it, but it didn't get better than it was before it. I think one of the problems that we have in this country is a blessing in its genesis, which is our revolution worked out really good. Revolutions historically do not work out well, right? There was the song by the Beatles, Revolution. I don't think a lot of people actually listened to the words and understood it. Right. It was not a pro-revolutionary song. It was a very anti-revolutionary song because think of all the other revolutions and tell me one that worked out to the benefit of the people who fought it the way that the American Revolution did. And I'm not going to make you do it. You got other things to talk about. But I defy you in the live chat here. There's well over 100 people in just the live chat. Name one. Anyway, go ahead.
So I am friends with this guy, David Himes, out of California, and I think he was trained as like an anthropologist or an archaeologist or something, but he spent a lot of his career sort of doing contracting for various international organizations and investigating war crimes sites. So not a sexy job to dig up a 3-year-old mass grave, you know, outside of Mosul or in Zambia or something. But he says the exact same thing you did, which is like, do not go sort of having a masturbation session about how great it'll be. All we need is a good civil war. That'll set things right. And his statement is, you know, civil war is like Godzilla stomping through your neighborhood every single week. You know, so the ballot box doesn't always work. The soap box doesn't always work. But these are still a lot better than trying to jump right to rider trucks full of explosives.
Yeah. I actually had a person that lived through the Bosnian War on the show years ago. And he said some of the things that went on were so horrific, it's hard to even explain it. There were instances of one family, males raping the females of another family that they had been neighbors to. So that their side, which had the advantage, would believe that they really were on their side and wouldn't kill them.
Mm-hmm.
Like that
mm-hmm.
level of depravity is not something you want.
Yeah.
It also makes me think of Eisenhower's quote where he said, I hate war as only a soldier can hate war. Oh. Someone who's seen it in all its futility, its misery, and its mm-hmm. stupidity.
Yep, absolutely.
And I think people need to awaken to that is what when you, I had a guy that did some tree work for me here and he, my wife went and told him what I'd do. And I'm like, damn it, he's going to want to talk about it. And he did. And he's a young guy, about 28, 29 years old. And he was like, but actually, you know what I'm going to say? He said, right? But actually, I think we'd be better off if it just happened. So I, instead of trying to even turn that back, I just said, let me ask you a totally off-the-wall question here. I noticed you don't wear Kevlar chaps when you're running that chainsaw. If you put that chainsaw on your thigh, how long can you go before you're out of business and waiting to recover? He goes, probably like a month. I'm like, so you can't not work for months, but you're ready to fight the zombies.
Right.
So you see the disconnect here. And mm-hmm. you're like, well, yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I guess, but you know, what do you think you're going to do? Like, how many times does an Amazon box show up at your house a week?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, if people start actually thinking about it, you realize how dumb this mindset is. Yeah. Like, the only people I know that crave war are either sociopaths or they've never seen it.
Yeah.
That's the only two, right? Or they don't have to fight it. Right. I'm not talking about the people with the levers, the people that are moving the pieces around on the big giant risk board. You know, like people that actually had to fight war or live through war, hate war. Like I think Eisenhower was one thing he was wrong about when he said it's only a soldier can. The people that do worst in war are the civilians where the war is fought.
Absolutely.
You're actually better off being a combatant because then you have a supply line behind you and, you know, sooner or later, for all the talk, you know, when wars go long enough and hard enough, people start stealing from the population.
Yep.
We're the good guys in World War II. Yeah, we still fucking broke into people's houses and stole all their shit.
Yep.
We were extended in our supply lines as a survival mechanism.
Yep. You know, all the time in my role as a state rep, I argue with people who will either say, you know, we need to jump right to revolution or, you know, politics is stupid. It never accomplishes anything. Look, Trump has been in office for a year. You, Travis, have been in office for 3 years. You haven't ended the income tax yet. You haven't given us machine guns. You haven't done this, that, and the other thing. And I'm like, yeah, you know, it is absolutely true that we have not achieved 100% of our goals in the last 15 minutes. This is sadly, you know, it's the quote, eternal vigilance, you know, is the price. You're never going to win 100% of the time. You have to keep fighting. The other side is always fighting back. They're well funded. So in negotiation and business, they talk about BATNA, the best alternative to a negotiated agreement. So, you know, politics sucks and you never get 100% of what you want. And I had one really big fight recently. So this is my second term in the New Hampshire legislature. In my first term, actually, maybe it was last year, the budget came up. And I had told party leadership all along, I will not vote for the Republican budget if the Office of Refugee Resettlement still exists in New Hampshire. I want it defunded. And they said, we understand. We don't necessarily have the votes to do it. And I said, okay, great. I'd never stab you in the back, but I'm telling you, I'm stabbing you in the front. You do not have my vote.
Yeah.
And I said, understood. Fair enough. It came up and I voted no. And the Republican budget failed 172 votes to 173 votes. And I immediately got a text from party leadership. If we go all in and support you next year in defunding the Office of Refugee Resettlement, will you flip your vote right now? And I said, yes. And, you know, down in the front, he stood up and, you know, Mr. Speaker, we would like to redo the vote. And so we redid the vote, and I flipped my vote, and the budget passed 173 to 172. Okay. And, you know, people say there's no honor among thieves. There may or may not be. There's honor among certain politicians. And yeah. So the New Hampshire leadership went all in, and we tried really hard to defund the Office of Refugee Resettlement. Literally hundreds of protesters came out during the hearings. The hearings went for hours and hours. We didn't manage it this year, even though we tried. Everyone did their best. And so I've got people on Twitter saying, you know, oh, F you, Travis, you know, F the Republicans. They're worthless. They couldn't do anything. And like, we went all in. We tried for the first time in 20 years. There was a very serious effort, and we're going to try again next year. And so, yeah, that sucks. I wish it were otherwise.
Yeah.
But would you rather have civil war than that? Like, you know, no.
You know, we're talking about sci-fi some today, and I was always a Star Trek fan until Kurtzman came and ruined it. Either you know what I meant when I said that, or you don't, and it doesn't matter. It's like Harley Davidson. If I have to explain it, you won't understand. I always compare like the Republicans and the Democrats, and I'm talking about the political class, to like the Federation and the Romulans. And the freaking Democrats are the Romulans. They have a plan. They stick to it. They basically use Alinsky's rules for radicals. They make the Federation accountable to everything that they say they're accountable to. And then they do whatever the fuck they have to win. And if they have a failure, they don't quit. They don't abandon it. And they keep persistently trying to get it done. And they hang together, right? And Republicans, and I think there's just a psychological thing, and it's very unfortunate because it leads to more totalitarianism. The more liberty-minded you are, the more reason you're going to tell a person that 99% agrees with you to go fuck themselves, right? When you're totalitarian-minded, you can deal with the 1% like it's not even there, right? They're defending this retard up in Maine now who's literally a Nazi, but they spent how long shrieking because Elon Musk threw his hand up and blew a kiss to everybody and called him and you look at that and you go, doesn't make any sense. But actually, if you look at it tactically, it makes absolute perfect sense. Right?
It's absolutely offensive if you believe in intellectual consistency, if you believe in telling. But yeah. And so actually on the you're a Nazi, I have another amusing political story, which is as of last week, am the first state rep in something like 10 years to be officially censured by a vote of the New Hampshire House. And the reason for this is I think everyone here is probably familiar with the phrase theater kids. And this is often used for those on the left who are doing drama and this and that. And so I made a joke. I said, you know, we need a final solution for the theater kids. I typed it. It was a tweet. And it was lowercase final solution. And it was for theater kids, you know, in the same way that one might say, you know, nuke or something. But the left said, this is it. We finally caught him. He has been revealed as a secret Nazi. So they went all in. Happy Ireland. And so there were hearings and there were more hearings and there was an official vote and everything. And so, you know, they made speeches against me on my friend, Representative, Donald McFarland made a wonderful speech, about, free expression and First Amendment rights. And I made a speech and said, Democrats have an anti-Semitism problem. Just across the border in Maine, we have a guy with an SS tattoo, not just, you know, German military, not just Nazi. SS, you know, the pinnacle of horrible. We have one Democratic rep in this chamber who has joined a convoy to Gaza supported by an actual terrorist organization. We have another state rep who has been asked to condemn Hamas and has refused to do so because they're sort of a legitimate struggle, And, you know, and on the other hand, you've got me. I am a lifetime dues-paying member, and I'm not Jewish, I'm Catholic, but a lifetime member of the Jews for the Preservation of Firearms Ownership. You're trying to make this thing something it's absolutely not. But the left just has a few talking points. They've got a few nasty, terrible words. If they call you racist, you need to immediately apologize and say, no, that's not true. If they call you anti-Semitic. And this is one of the things, talking about the fourth turning, about Kondratiev waves, talking about all these other things, which is things change when they finally run their course. And the left has had a whole bunch of psychological and political tools that they have used for 50 or 70 years since World War II, because we've been embedded in a certain narrative, a narrative about the civil rights struggle, a narrative about the war in Europe. And these tools worked pretty well. And so anytime they used one, a rightist would, you know, he's standing up there holding a banner for, you know, the Second Amendment or budget cuts or whatever. And he would get accused of this and he would shriek, drop his thing, take 20 steps back and say, no, that's not me. You misunderstood. I'll stop doing this thing. And this worked so well for them that they forgot all of their other tools. This is the only tool they've got. Meanwhile, on our side, we're just getting utterly exhausted. And we have seen a few brave pioneers say, I refuse to stop. I refuse to apologize. I refuse to accept your frame. And that has entirely defanged them. So this game is almost fully played out. And again, interesting times. Everything is changing.
Yeah, when they throw shit at me, I just say, and.
Right.
That's my entire response. And or okay.
Yep.
Right. Like if the minute you're defending yourself, you're losing.
Yes.
Right. And this is also straight out of Alinsky's Rules for Radicals. Right. You find something you can humiliate or attack, and then you press it and you press it and you press it, and you never let up, and you keep pressing on that one thing, and you attack with humiliation and insult.
Yes.
Right. That is. And I did a show not too long ago, and I thought about maybe the right needs to pick up the book.
Right? 100%
agree. Maybe turn that shit around. But yeah, like my best response has been end.
Yep. Another of Alinsky's rules, which is a tactic that is fun for your side, is great. And I tweeted about this. So the censure thing, my speech, I ended. I said, you know, okay, so I've accused these people of being theater kids, and now they are censuring me. Well, you know, I'm a student of the arts. I have a book coming out, and I know that the absolute most important thing for a drama is to have a satisfying third act. So here is my proposal for a satisfying third act to this little comedy that you whipped up. Please vote to censure me. I'm voting to censure me. I want everyone to vote to censure me.
Yeah.
And and we did, and I got censured, and I turned around, and I give my best Nixon to the entire audience, and I walked away and made the whole thing into a laughingstock comedy. And our side was going wild. People are making memes. There's back slapping. There's high fives. And it fell entirely flat. And so by doing this, you know, hopefully, I have removed this weapon from the left in New Hampshire, for the foreseeable future. So yeah, have fun with, your tactics and
yeah, the whole censorship and legislatures and all. It's like, yeah, you know what? That piece of paper and $5, you can get a shitty coffee at Starbucks. It doesn't mean anything. And I don't give a shit.
Yes.
Like that ends the shit out of that really, really fast. And they hold it up like it's some glorious thing they did. And if like some rep votes against it and it fails barely, then even if it fails by like 10 votes, the one person that you expected to vote, yes, it's all their fault. It's and theater kids is the perfect term for all this shit.
Yes.
It really is. And theater kids should not run society.
Yep.
Theater kids should do plays.
Yes. Yes.
And play music and sing and dance. That's what they're good at. And they shouldn't be in charge of things.
And
they
this
be a director
back to,
one day and direct their little play, but we don't need them directing Earth. Right?
This gets back to the old woman wearing her Handmaid's Tale cosplay costume standing out in front protesting.
Please read another book.
Right. She's
Jeez,
probably a wonderful person.
Please read another. And don't, and it, not 50 Shades of Grey.
Right? Right.
Don't go read those two books and then act like you have moral high ground with one of them. Just shut up.
Right.
So, but
a person like this has a role in the right society. This woman should take off the Handmaid's Tale costume and be baking cookies for neighborhood kids. And the theater kids should get out of the state legislature and the federal legislature. And they should plays. They should in the park. There's a role for everyone in our society. There's a joke, right? In heaven, the mechanics are German, the cooks are French, etc. And in heaven, and in hell, it's reversed. You know, the policemen are German, the chefs are English, etc. So we live in this hell version where the theater kids are in the legislature, the grandmothers are wearing sexy handmaiden costumes. You know, it's a bizarre world.
Yeah. Hey, let's hit two questions I have for you from the audience, but him quick because I need to wrap this up. We're almost at 2 hours here. Second Life Farm says, who are your biggest influences on your worldview and your writing?
Great. I have read the novel The Moon is a Harsh Mistress by Robert Heinlein like 30 or 40 times. And so that was where I didn't know it by the term, but anarcho-capitalism came in. David Friedman, who is the son of Milton Friedman, has written a bunch of great books on anarcho-capitalism, the machinery of freedom, legal systems very different from our own, Law's Order are three books by him that I would recommend. Robert Nozick, who wrote Anarchy, State, and Utopia. That was a lot. There's not particular things, but I think that all of this intellectual, libertarian, pro-capitalist theory, Hayek, et cetera, needs to be balanced against the Christian worldview that we're all embedded in and should be embedded in. There isn't one particular a writer on that. So that was a pretty big emphasis. But then I'm going to go meta for a little bit, which is worldviews come in a continuum. And on one end, there are very structured, theoretical, structured and analytical worldviews. So like Ayn Rand is an example of a very structured and analytical worldview. On the other end, you have sort of messier, but wiser and more resilient, sort of less crystalline, more made out of wood, not made out of diamonds. And so you see sort of Anglo-American things like Tolkien, who is the guy? H.L. Mencken. I am much more of a empiricist, thick culture, learn slow and evolve things over time. So I threw out a whole bunch of stuff, Milton Friedman, Robert Nozick, et cetera. Those are the crystalline end, but at least sort of more of muddle through and have a thick culture, Tolkien and other Anglo-American thinkers.
Cool. Tell people here real quick. Hold on. I got one more for you. This is from Stephen Sutherland. You told a little of your backstory, including being a state rep. What experiences in your own life changed your ideas the most?
That is a great question. I'll answer it, but first a little anecdote. I'm from the Northern Appalachians in New Jersey. My wife is from the Southern Appalachians down in Tennessee. Her dad was a pastor, and her dad, who's now passed, had a great story, which is the congregation or the church elders of this little Southern church were interviewing a new pastor, a potential pastor for their congregation. And a guy came in and he answered every question great. And it seemed like a no-brainer, like, yeah, this is the guy. But then one of the community elders said, I've got one concern, which is he hasn't failed. And this is a really pretty deep point, which is, I think it was maybe Mike Tyson who said, everybody has a plan until they're hit in the face. Mm-hmm. I remember being 16 and arrogant. I knew a heck of a lot more about the world at 16 than I do now at 55. I knew how it all worked. And, you know, I was an arrogant little snot. I was the smartest kid in the high school, the smartest kid to ever go through the school system. I'd never failed at anything. And then I got a lot more life. I got thrown out of college for not being a particularly good student. The Berlin Wall fell and I lost my ROTC scholarship. So the question is what experience, and I'm going to say what bag of experiences. I'm going to say a bunch of failures, a bunch of little different or big failures. You don't learn a lot about life or yourself from winning. It's good to win, but you really learn from the failures. So I have been lucky enough to have a good handful of those.
Cool, man. So you want to tell people how they can learn more about your work, get your books and stuff. And
sure.
Folks, the book here is Red State Mars. I'm going to read the blurb on the front of it from Larry Correa, tough as nails pioneer families and a great sci-fi war story wrapped up in a huge epic of Mars's fight for freedom. Loved it. So that's the book. It's a pretty good daggone blurb to have there, man. Tell people how they can get this book, your other books, and learn more about your work.
Sure. I'm on Twitter as @MorlockP. That's Morlock from H.G. Wells, The Time Machine, Morlock, and then P at the end for publishing because someone else already had Morlock. Or you probably can search my name, Travis Corcoran. I'm also on Twitter as Travis, and then the number 4, and then NH for New Hampshire. So the first one is about writing and farming, and the second one is a lot more New Hampshire legislation and coalition building, et cetera. If you go to Amazon and type in Travis Corcoran, you'll find everything there from the Escape the City homesteading books to Red State Mars to a bunch of other stuff I've written. I think the books or the new book, Red State Mars, is also available at ARC.press and Passage.press. Passage is the parent company. Really great new publishing company, totally concentrated on conservative and pro-American stuff, and they have a lot of stuff. They've got and then their sub-imprint, Arc Press, is genre stuff. So science fiction and some youth adventure off in the direction. I think they did Hardy Boy reprints. They've got sort of a modern Hardy Boys-like thing called American Treasure Hunter. Those two organizations are full of great people bringing great literature to Americans. I saw something scrolled by in the sidebar. The young need dreams, not just practical homesteading wisdom. And so on the topic of the young need dreams, right, we need to build a culture. Cultures are built around, you know, myths, which are shared dreams, shared goals. There's a huge amount of work to be done. Elon is great for, you know, building technology. Every person listening to this who's just, you know, mowing his own lawn and taking care of his own kids, that's the most important thing you can be doing. There's a lot of different roles to build America and build Western civilization. And technology is one. Tending your own garden, raising your own family is probably the most important. But also building culture. We live in a slop of left-wing culture. You go to Barnes & Noble or something, and, you know, everything there is, you know, I was a female sex slave to a barbarian minotaur. I mean, that's literally a series.
Okay.
It's outselling anything I'll ever write by like 1,000 to 1. TV, Marvel slop, all of the stuff. We've got to build our own culture. We've got to recommend good books. You know, don't recommend my stuff to a friend just because I'm based and this and that. You know, read it, and if you like it, then recommend it.
Yeah.
Because we also need to do good quality work, right? We can't just recommend right-wing slop to each other. We need to hold ourselves to high standards.
Yeah. There's another comment here from Darkwing Dave on Twitch, which I have to read because we don't get many people on Twitch. I'm not even sure how I ended up there. Somebody asked me to do it, and I clicked a button, and it happened. Never underestimate the power of human stupidity, Robert Heinlein. I agree with that. I also say never underestimate the power of human genius.
Yeah.
There's a dichotomy in that. As much stupidity as there is, humans are smart. We just tend to be stupid in groups. And the bigger the group gets, the more stupid comes to the top, like cream rising to the top, except it ain't what you wanted. If you want the cream, you don't want the stupid, but it acts like cream in large numbers. It makes you think of another sci-fi thing, right? Men in Black, when Will Smith tells Tommy Lee Jones's character, people are smart. He goes, no, a person is smart.
Yes, yes.
People are stupid. Yep. Like, there is some reality. Anyway, man, I'm going to make sure that links to your book and your Twitter account and all that, or X account now, are all in the show notes today.
Awesome. So
right down there, if you're watching the video, there's a link. The first link in the video notes goes over to my website on the audio side, where this all gets distributed to Apple Podcasts and Value for Value Networks and Spotify and Pocket Casts and everything else. And all the extra links, because I only stick so many links in a YouTube video, will be over there for you. So if you didn't write it down or whatever, you're listening to it driving home from work, you can pick up your copy of the book that way. And I'll even link to his author page on Amazon, because he's a humble guy. I didn't tell you he's got a bunch of other books, and they all might be worth a read. So, Travis, thank you for being with us.
Hey, this was a great conversation. I really enjoyed it. Thanks so much for having me.
Take care, man.
Have a good one.
All right, guys, real quick, I am going to go super fast in my wrap-up because we were on so long today. I just do want to let you know about the item of the day. Remember, you can always help us out by doing your online shopping, starting at tspaz.com. That's T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Today's item of the day is not a survival item, except it kind of is, in that you can keep yourself from getting sick, or you can actually just survive having guests over and make them decent food. It is the Thermo Maven Instant Read Meat Thermometer. It's the reason I brought it around today. It's on sale for under $10. This is a $20 piece of equipment, and I mean, if that's what it costs, I would pay for it. It is a great meat thermometer. It is, you know, people always talk about, yeah, you need a meat thermometer to make sure you don't undercook. No, what you need the meat thermometer in for mostly is so you don't overcook. Everybody knows how expensive beef has gotten, and there's nothing worse, you know, whatever your level of cook is you want, when you spend like $30 on a steak and you cook it and you overcook it. You can always cook it a little more. You can't uncook what you've already done. Meat thermometer is the way to go. The problem with meat thermometers is many, unfortunately. There should be 100 brands of this, and they should all be good, and they're not. Number one, accuracy. This is actually accurate. Number two, when you open it and it turns on, yeah, they need to be set so that if you don't close it, that they shut themselves off so it doesn't drain your battery. Most of them don't do that, unfortunately. And the next is they all use retarded batteries that are hard to change and hard to get your hands on. This uses a AAA, and if you can use a Phillips screwdriver, you can change the battery in about 35 seconds. It also does another thing. You lose them. So this one has a magnet, so it sticks to things that are metal. Usually when you're cooking, you're around something that's metal. And last but not least, and not really important but good, it actually has a built-in bottle opener, so you can pop that beer while you're enjoying yourself out by the grill over a weekend or something like that. Anyway, guys, it is totally worth picking one of these up if you don't own one already. If you have like somebody in your orbit who you know won't pick something up like this for themselves and they cook for you, get them one. They'll cook better. Your food will suck less. Anyway, with that, as always, you can help us out by doing your online shopping at tspaz.com. This was a great discussion with Travis today. Again, I highly recommend that you do pick up a copy of his book. We almost have an author series going here, right? I had Travis on today. Tomorrow we have an expert counsel show. And then we have a work-in show on Monday next week. Brad Thor will be on the show with us. That's a pretty big guy to interview. We just made that work with my vacation and his availability. So tune in for that one. And then you're going to have rewinds for the next 2 weeks. After that, I'm going to be in Colorado for about a week and a half with my family in the Estes Park, Rocky Mountain National, a little bit of stuff we're going to do in Denver. I'm going to go to the Denver Aquarium, swim with the sharks. It's going to be a fun trip. I'll come back all energized. We'll pick up from there, and we'll rock through the rest of the summer. Take care, guys. Have a great day. And we won't have a live tomorrow, even though there'll be a new show. So I'll also say to those of you that only tune in for the live, have a great weekend.
They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way.